What if God was black? What if freedom wasn't found in parliaments or pulpits, but in dreadlocks, drumbeats, and smoke rising from the hills of Jamaica? This is the untold story of Rastafari, a fire born from slavery, crowned by a king in Ethiopia, and carried by the voice of a barefoot prophet named Bob Marley. It's the journey of a people who turned pain into prophecy, exile into empire, and herb into holy scripture. From the blood of coral gardens to the dreams of Shashamane, this is not just a story, it's a revolution in spirit. The lion still roars, and the world is still listening. Welcome to the History of the Caribbean's podcast. If you haven't already, please consider following us on your favorite podcast platform. Today, we present to you Rastafari, A Journey Through Time, Episode 3. Let's dive into this thrilling narrative together. Chapter 9, When the Lion Fell. The death of a man is rarely just the death of a man. Sometimes it is the death of belief, of illusion, of certainty. And other times, it is not death at all, but transformation in disguise. 1975. Ethiopia trembled, not from earthquake or drought, but from the footsteps of soldiers. The ancient land of kings, the last uncolonized empire in Africa, the spiritual home of millions across the diaspora, had fallen into the grip of the Derg, a brutal Marxist-Leninist military junta, thirsty for power and driven by vengeance. The revolution had begun in whispers, but by the time it reached the gates of Jubilee Palace, it was thunder, and the thunder was coming for a king. Haile Selassie I, King of Kings, Lord of Lords, Elect of God, conquering lion of the tribe of Judah, was arrested. He was 83 years old, frail, isolated, surrounded not by prophets and psalmists, but by tanks and betrayal. The emperor, once welcomed on red carpets by popes and presidents, now sat alone under house arrest, his staff dismissed, his legacy mocked by the new regime, his throne gone, his nation in turmoil. And then, on August 27, 1975, came the news that shattered the bones of the faithful. Haile Selassie was dead. The official report said natural causes: heart failure, age, quiet passing. But the silence screamed louder than any truth. Whispers swirled of assassination, of strangulation, of suffocation by pillow. The regime buried his body in secret. No ceremony, no crown, no chant, no lion, no glory, just dirt. And for the Rastafari movement, it was as if the sky had collapsed. How could God die? For decades, Rastas had preached his divinity, declared him the living God, the returned Christ, the King of Zion. His coronation in 1930 had been their revelation. His face adorned every altar. His name was invoked in every chant. His image was inked on skin, printed on fabric, burned into memory. And now the newspapers said he was gone, dead, buried, erased. A spiritual tremor ripped through the hills of Jamaica. Some wept. Some refused to believe it. Others spiraled into confusion. Churches mocked. Governments scoffed. Radio hosts chuckled through broadcasts. So they asked, "Is your God dead now?" But Rastafari was not a house built on shallow foundations. It was a mountain, and mountains do not fall. They transform. Across the island, in ghettos and forests, in reasoning circles and Nyabingi chants, the Rasta elders gathered, not to mourn, but to listen, to interpret, to divine. And slowly, the clarity came. Jah does not die. The physical form of Haile Selassie may have returned to dust, but his spirit, his energy, his essence, his role in prophecy, remained ever living. Just as Christ had been crucified but rose in glory, so too had Selassie passed into a new realm. He was no longer confined by throne or flesh. He had become spirit eternal. Some Rastas clung tighter to their belief. Others revised their understanding. A new theological split began to take shape within the movement. Some insisted he had not truly died at all, that reports were Babylonian lies. Others accepted the physical death, but declared it irrelevant, for the God they served was not limited by mortality. And in the midst of this spiritual reckoning, another lion began to fall. Bob Marley. By 1980, the prophet of reggae was visibly fading. He was touring the world with an unshakable smile. Yes, but his body carried a quiet agony. The cancer that had begun in his toe had metastasized into his liver, into his brain, into his lungs. Yet still he sang. He sang of Africa, of Zion, of revolution. He sang as if trying to outrun time itself. In September of 1980, Bob collapsed while jogging in Central Park. The diagnosis was final. Doctors gave him weeks. But he went on. He traveled to Germany for alternative treatment. Rastas around the world prayed, fasted, chanted. But Jah was preparing to bring his messenger home. May 11, 1981, Bob Marley, age 36, passed away in Miami. His last words to his son Ziggy, "Money can't buy life." News of his death swept across the world like a black wave. Crowds wept in the streets of Kingston. Ethiopia flew its flag at half-mast. Radio stations across continents played redemption song on repeat. World leaders sent condolences. Churches held vigils. And in the hills of Jamaica, dreadlocked men and women fell to their knees, not in despair, but in recognition. A prophet had returned to Zion. Bob Marley's funeral was a state event. Held on May 21, 1981, it was a convergence of worlds. Politicians, priests, Rastas, musicians, diplomats, all under one roof, bound by the gravity of his life. His body lay in a coffin lined with red, gold, and green. A guitar at his side. A Bible in his hand. A lion embroidered into his suit. Tears flowed. Drums echoed. Psalms were chanted. But Marley's death brought not just grief. It brought clarity. Because if Haile Selassie's death had cracked the Rasta movement, Bob's death began to cement its resurrection. No longer could the faith be dismissed as fringe, as myth, as madness. Two lives, one royal, one rural, had changed the world. And even in death, they did not fade. Bob's music surged. His albums sold in millions. Legend would become the best-selling reggae album of all time. Selassie's speeches were reprinted, studied, analyzed. Universities began to research Rastafari. Tourists flocked to Jamaica, not just for beaches, but to learn of dreadlocks and Ital food and Nyabingi drums. And through it all, the spiritual core remained intact. Rastas understood now what they had always known, but had never been forced to articulate. Jah is not bound by body. Jah is spirit. Jah is I and I, in all, above all, around all. Selassie's death did not kill the movement. It purified it. The false believers fell away. The tourists lost interest. But those who remained, they were forged in fire. They overstood what the world could not. That Rastafari is not worship of man, but reverence of divine order. That the Lion of Judah walks not just in Ethiopia, but in every heart that beats in rhythm with truth. And so, as the dust settled over two graves, one in Addis Ababa, the other in 9 Mile, a new chapter began. One born of loss, but filled with rebirth. Because when the lion fell, he did not die. He roared into the next realm. Chapter 10, Faith Without Sight. In every great movement, there comes a moment when belief must step beyond sight. When the tangible is taken away, and what remains is the essence, unseen, but undeniable. It is the moment when faith is no longer about seeing miracles, but about being the miracle. For Rastafari, that moment arrived in the wake of two deaths that cracked the earth beneath their feet. First, in 1975, Haile Selassie I, the man they had crowned as the living god, was pronounced dead by the Ethiopian dirge. His body, hastily buried in secret, was hidden from the world. There were no photos, no ceremony, no open casket. Just silence and contradiction. And then, in 1981, Bob Marley, the prophet who had carried the Rastafari message to the four corners of the earth, succumbed to cancer, his voice stilled at 36 years old. The two spiritual pillars, one divine, one messianic, had departed the physical realm. The question that hung heavy over Jamaica, Africa, and the global diaspora was simple and devastating. What now? For many outside the movement, this was the predicted end. Without the emperor alive, without the voice of Marley echoing through new songs, surely the faith would crumble. Surely the dreadlocked ones would vanish into myth. The world waited for Rastafari to collapse like a prophecy disproven. But they didn't understand. Because Rastafari was never about worshiping flesh. It was about recognizing divinity in all living things. It was about awakening the God within. And those who had truly overstood the teachings of His Imperial Majesty and the message of Bob Marley knew that their passing was not the end. It was the beginning of a deeper test. In those years that followed, something extraordinary happened. The Rastafari movement did not collapse. It diversified, matured, and began to evolve in rich, dynamic directions. What had once been a mostly oral, grassroots faith now began to take on spiritual complexity. Not fragmentation, not division, but growth. This growth was marked by the emergence and solidification of the mansions of Rastafari. Each mansion represented a unique perspective within the faith. They were different rooms in the same spiritual house. They did not always agree, but they were united in one truth: Jah lives. And that truth did not die with Selassie or Marley, it deepened. The Nyabingi Order. The oldest and most mystic of the mansions, Nyabingi emerged from the hills and forests, where ancient drums still echoed like heartbeats through the night. Named after Queen Nyabingi, a legendary East African resistance leader, this mansion emphasized purity, liberty, and direct connection to Jah through ritual and chant. Their ceremonies, called grunations, were sacred gatherings where drums spoke, chalices were passed, and psalms were chanted deep into the early hours. The Nyabingi elders rejected materialism, politics, and compromise. They held firm to the belief that Selassie was not just a king, but God incarnate, the fulfillment of revelation. In the absence of his flesh, they found him in spirit, in wind, in water, in the pulse of the bass drum. They lived simply, often in the hills, disconnected from Babylon's illusions. They wore white robes, grew their locks long and uncombed, and used ganja as sacrament. Their songs were ancient, their silence powerful. They became the spiritual spine of the faith. Bobo Ashanti. In the early 1990s, the Bobo Ashanti Mansion emerged with increasing presence, though its foundations were rooted decades earlier. Clad in turbans and long flowing robes, Bobo men and women practiced a strict form of priestly liberty, with fasting, separation of the sexes, daily prayer, and discipline being core principles. They referred to their high priest as King Emmanuel Charles Edwards, considered part of the Divine Trinity alongside Marcus Garvey and Haile Selassie. For Bobo Ashanti, this trinity represented God the Father Selassie, God the Son Emmanuel, and God the Prophet Garvey. They were politically vocal, spiritually intense, and deeply committed to black liberation. Their camp on Jah Mount Zion Hill, outside Bull Bay in Jamaica, became a hub of scripture, song, and sacred fire. They took faith from belief into order, from spirit into ritual. To outsiders, Bobo Ashanti were often misunderstood, seen as separatists or zealots. But within the movement, they represented holy fire, unyielding, uncompromising, devout. The 12 Tribes of Israel, founded in 1968 by Vernon Carrington, known to followers as Prophegad, the 12 tribes took a more structured and biblical approach to Rastafari. Members were assigned a tribe based on their birth month, echoing the 12 sons of Jacob. They read the Bible daily, two chapters of the Old Testament and one of the New, and emphasized spiritual discipline and self-development. Unlike some other mansions, the 12 tribes did not insist on Haile Selassie's divinity in a literal sense. They saw him as a divinely appointed monarch, a fulfillment of prophecy, but focused more on Christ consciousness within, on living as sons and daughters of God. Musically, the 12 tribes had a strong connection to reggae. Many great artists, including Marley himself, had ties to this mansion. They emphasized love, unity, and preparation for repatriation, not just to Ethiopia, but to the true self. They became the bridge between Rastafari and the broader world, often more open to interfaith dialogue and academic interpretation. Living without sight, but not without vision, with Selassie no longer in the physical, and Marley no longer on the mic, each mansion had to redefine what it meant to follow Jah. The struggle shifted from surviving persecution to preserving spiritual integrity in a world that had started to commercialize Rasta symbols. Rastafari was now global. Bob Marley's image appeared on posters, t-shirts, billboards. Ganja became trendy. Dreadlocks became fashion. But for the true Rastas, this was Babylon's attempt to water down the fire. And so a new challenge emerged. How do you hold onto the soul of a movement when the world wants to wear its skin but not its spirit? For many, the answer came through inner work. They turned deeper into Ital living, into community farming, into spiritual retreats, into the study of Ethiopian history, ancient scriptures, African liberation philosophy, and natural healing. Rastafari became less about external displays and more about internal transformation. They no longer needed to prove Selassie's divinity to the world. They only needed to reflect divine truth through their lives. Modern Rasta women stepping forward. The years that followed also saw the emergence of Rasta women's voices, long silenced by patriarchy, both within and outside the movement. Sisters began to challenge rigid gender roles, while still honoring the spiritual foundation of the faith. They wrote, they sang, they preached, they reasoned. Women like Sister Carol, Judy Moat, Queen Omega, and Queen Ifrika carried the teachings of Jah in feminine form, a balance long needed in the dreadlocked chorus. Rastafari, they said, was not just for men. It was for I and I, the divine in all forms, masculine and feminine, ancestor and child. The faith that endures. To walk by faith and not by sight is the highest form of spiritual maturity. And Rastafari, now decades beyond the deaths of its earthly prophets, has proven itself to be eternal. The drums still beat in the hills of Jamaica. The psalms still rise through the smoke of chalices. The liberty still guides Rastas through every city, every continent. Whether in the markets of Accra, the streets of London, the beaches of Brazil, or the yards of Kingston, the fire still burns. Rastafari is no longer waiting for the world to understand, because it has already overstood itself. Chapter 11, The Blood of the Martyrs. There are wounds people carry not on their bodies, but in their bones. Scars that live beyond generations, etched into spirit, passed down in whispered memory. These wounds do not fade with time, they deepen. They become sacred, because within their pain is a truth too powerful to be forgotten. For Rastafari, Coral Gardens is that wound. It is more than a place, more than an event. It is a crucible of suffering, a symbol of betrayal, a moment when Babylon showed its truest face, and the dreadlocked faithful paid for their convictions in blood, silence, and fire. The story begins long before 1963. It begins with fear. By the 1950s and early 60s, the Rastafari movement had grown from a scattered fringe into a potent spiritual force. Though still small in numbers, its symbolism, black divinity, resistance to empire, communal living, dreadlocks as sacred identity, ganja as sacrament, stood in direct opposition to colonial Jamaica's values. It was a movement that refused to kneel before queen or cross. It bowed only to Jah and to the Jamaican establishment. That was unforgivable. The press mocked Rastas. Schools excluded their children. Police targeted them for routine harassment. Rastafari became synonymous with criminality in the public imagination, a lazy myth carefully cultivated by the state to justify aggression. They were labeled as mad, dangerous, subhuman. Their spiritual practices were twisted into superstition. Their dreadlocks, a crown in their eyes, were viewed as filth. And in the upper echelons of government and law enforcement, a quiet consensus grew. The Rasta problem needed to be solved. April 11, 1963, the day it all ignited. It was Holy Thursday, the start of Easter weekend. In Coral Gardens, a lush coastal area just outside Montego Bay, an altercation occurred between a group of Rastas and the authorities. The specifics of how it began remain disputed to this day. Some say it was an act of retaliation for years of police harassment. Others believe it was a land dispute that turned volatile. Some speak of self-defense, others of state provocation. What is certain is that blood was spilled, and the state responded with unrestrained fury. Prime Minister Alexander Bustamante, already known for his hostility toward Rastas, gave a chilling order: bring in all Rastas, dead or alive. What followed was a state-sponsored pogrom. Police and soldiers swept through the streets and countryside like a plague. Rastas, regardless of their involvement in the Coral Gardens incident, were hunted like animals. They were dragged from their homes, from their workplaces, from marketplaces and alleyways. Many were beaten on sight. Others were taken to police stations, stripped naked, shaved, brutalized, tortured. Some were burned. Others were starved. Dreadlocks were ripped from scalps in clumps. Ganja was forced into mouths. Bibles were defiled. They were not treated as human. They were treated as enemies of the state. Estimates vary, but hundreds of Rastafari men and women were rounded up during the Coral Gardens crackdown. Many were imprisoned without trial. Others were never seen again. Families were torn apart. Children left orphaned. Women widowed. Communities traumatized. And all of it was done in the name of order. The massacre did not end that weekend. Its consequences echoed for decades. For a long time, the Jamaican state refused to speak of it. School books omitted it. Officials denied responsibility. Survivors were told to forget. And so, Coral Gardens lived only in the memory of Rasta elders, passed down like forbidden scripture. Not written, but sung in Nyabingi chants, whispered in reasonings, honored in moments of silence when the drums went quiet. It became the cross of the movement. But like all martyrs' blood, it fertilized the roots. The massacre forced Rastafari into a new phase of spiritual evolution. Suffering had always been part of their liberty, but Coral Gardens brought clarity. Babylon would do anything to silence truth. And so the faith deepened. Rastas began to speak not just of resistance, but of redemption through struggle. They saw themselves in the Hebrew Israelites of old, beaten, exiled, enslaved, but never forsaken. The blood of Coral Gardens became their Passover, their holiest of wounds. And in the hills, among the Nyabingi, the chants grew louder. They tried to kill we, but Jah protect we. They burn we, but we're eyes. They lock we up, but we still chant. In time, the movement began to demand accountability. Through the voices of scholars, activists, journalists, and artists, Coral Gardens was brought into the light. Survivors gave testimony. Historians dug into the archives. Legal challenges were filed. And slowly, the world began to listen. Decades later, in 2017, after tireless campaigning by Rastafari elders and advocates, something miraculous happened. Jamaican Prime Minister Andrew Holness issued an official apology. "We express regret and sorrow for what happened at Coral Gardens. We acknowledge the pain that was caused and the injustice inflicted on the Rastafari community." It was not just words. The government established a $10 million Jamaican dollar reparations fund, intended to support survivors and their families. Land was promised for a heritage site to honor the victims. It was far from full justice, but it was a beginning. And when the announcement was made, Rasta elders stood tall in their white robes, their faces lined with time and pain and pride. They did not cheer. They did not gloat. They stood in silence, holding staff and chalice, and gave thanks, not to Babylon, but to Jah, because justice had not come from man. It had come from endurance, from faith without violence, from patience without surrender, from chanting the truth when no one listened. Coral Gardens had become holy ground. Today, on every April 11th, Rastafari gather across Jamaica to remember, not with parades, not with speeches, but with drumming, with chant, with reflection. And in every beat of the Nyabingi drum is the memory of those who were dragged away. In every cloud of Ganja smoke is the breath of those who never came back. In every silence between chants is the echo of a man being beaten for wearing his crown. They are the martyrs, not saints in cathedrals, but prophets in shacks, dreadlocked and defiant. Their blood cried out from the earth, and Jah heard it. Chapter 12, From Ganja to Gospel. In the hands of a Babylonian, ganja is a product, a substance, a drug to be taxed, sold, branded, and displayed under fluorescent lights in storefronts with names like Leaf & Company or Green Remedies. It's something to be bought with credit cards and weighed in grams. But in the hands of a Rasta, ganja is gospel. It is not smoked, it is sacrificed. It is not consumed, it is offered. Not for escape, but for awakening. Not to get high, but to get closer. Closer to self. Closer to Jah. Closer to the rhythm that beats behind all things. To understand ganja in Rastafari is to understand that it was never just a plant. It was a portal. Its roots dig into the soil of Africa. Its leaves unfurl like ancient scrolls. Its smoke rises like a psalm. And for generations, Rastas have held it with the same reverence that Christians hold communion, that Muslims hold prayer, that Hindus hold incense and fire. But the world, especially the Western world, never saw this. For decades, ganja was demonized, criminalized, painted with the same brush as cocaine, heroin, and crime. In the Caribbean, in Africa, in the Americas, colonial governments passed laws under British, Spanish, French, and American rule that outlawed the herb. Possession became a crime. Use became a stigma. Cultivation became a reason to jail, beat, exile, or kill. And Rastas became the primary target. Why? Because they refused to separate their faith from their fire. Because they dared to say that this plant, this weed, was holy. Because they gathered in circles, unapologetic, bare-chested, dreadlocked, chanting psalms through ganja smoke, and that terrified Babylon. Because in that smoke was truth. In that chalice was clarity. In that ritual was resistance. Ganja as sacrament, the living ritual. Within Rastafari, ganja is known by many names. The herb, the wisdom weed, Kali, lamb's bread, Ili, Isensi. Each name reflects a different layer of its purpose. It is not used recklessly. It is used ritually. The act of passing the chalice is sacred. It begins with invocation, praise to Jah. Then comes the blessing. The circle is formed. The pipe or chalice is lit, not to dull the senses, but to awaken them. Conversations deepen. Words slow. Scripture is read aloud. Eyes close, not in sleep, but in meditation. This is not intoxication. It is overstanding. The herb amplifies introspection. It quiets the ego. It opens the gate between flesh and spirit. To smoke ganja in this way is to engage in spiritual alchemy, to turn breath into prayer, thought into vibration, presence into prophecy. Rastas do not get high. They reason. Persecution and prohibition, Babylon's war on the holy herb. But the system could not allow this. In colonial Jamaica, laws against ganja were rooted in fear of spiritual rebellion. The Ganja Law of 1913 and its subsequent amendments were not just about public health, they were about control. They sought to stifle indigenous knowledge, African healing traditions, and any spiritual path that refused to bow to the crown or the church. And so ganja was banned. Fields were torched. Smokers were arrested. Dreadlocks were shaved. Rasta homes were raided. Chalices were smashed. Elders were beaten. Children watched their fathers dragged away, not for violence, but for lighting a pipe in honor of the Most High. This was not law enforcement. This was cultural genocide. And yet, Rastas never stopped. They continued to grow. In hidden corners of the Blue Mountains, behind zinc fences, in valleys where police did not dare go. They cultivated not just the plant, but the spirit behind the plant. Every seed sown was an act of rebellion. Every leaf dried in the sun was a chapter in their living gospel. And through the decades, the smoke never faded. If anything, it grew thicker. The irony of legalization, profit over prophecy. Then, in the early 2000s and 2010s, the world began to shift. Suddenly, ganja, once called the devil's weed, was being rebranded as a wellness product. Politicians who had passed strict anti-ganja laws now invested in cannabis companies. Pharmaceutical giants filed patents. Celebrities launched their own strains. Stores opened in Canada, California, Amsterdam, Barcelona. Legalization had arrived. But with it came a bitter irony. The same governments that had jailed Rastas for decades now sold ganja in glass jars, profiting from what was once considered criminal. No apologies. No reparations. No recognition. Rastas watched as Babylon turned their sacrament into commerce. The herb that had cost them their freedom, their dignity, their family, was now a multi-billion dollar industry. Their sacred rituals became tourist attractions. Their ganja fields became investment portfolios. And yet, many Rastas remained excluded from these profits. Most had no licenses, no legal land, no access to the business elite. Their years of persecution were not counted as experience, but as criminal records. The plant had been freed, but the profits remained caged. Rasta response, defending the holiness of the herb. Still, Rastafari did not respond with rage. They responded with clarity. They began to reassert the spiritual foundation of ganja, to remind the world that this was not just a crop, it was a sacrament. In sermons, in chants, in music, and in legal activism, they demanded recognition, not as suppliers, but as priests. Organizations like the Rastafari Indigenous Village, the Coral Gardens Benevolent Society, and the Ethiopian African Black International Congress began pushing for sacred cannabis rights, land access, and religious exemptions. Rastas called for the decriminalization of ganja for all, but also for the resacralization of ganja within the faith. Because if the herb is not holy, then it is not free. Ganja and the global Rasta movement. Across the globe, Rastafari communities continue to cultivate the herb as they always had, with reverence and purpose. In Ethiopia, Shashamane lands saw small fields growing in secret. In South Africa, Rasta farmers pushed against apartheid-era drug laws. In Trinidad, the herb was passed under starlight with psalms. In Brazil, reggae followers treated ganja as an offering to the Most High. The global movement remained united in one truth. The herb is the healing of the nation, not healing of the body alone, but of the mind, the spirit, the soul. A healing that could not be sold in dispensaries or packaged in sleek plastic. The herb was not for profit. It was for prophecy, the future, roots, or retail. And so today, the struggle continues. In one hand, the world holds opportunity. Decriminalization, medical research, economic empowerment. In the other, it holds erasure of Rasta wisdom, of spiritual roots, of sacred context. Rastas now stand at the crossroads, to participate or to remain separate, to enter the legal industry, or to protect the faith from commodification. There is no easy answer. Only the path of conscious liberty, guided not by profit, but by principle. And in the hills, in the drum circles, in the deep reasonings under moonlight, the chalice still burns. The smoke still rises. The prayers are still whispered. The herb remains holy, not because a government says so, but because Jah did.